Initially, we had sit down our program simply to consider the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill and Criminal Procedure Amendment Bill and possibly the sheriffs. But since then, there have been developments which we would need to apply our minds to. The first of these is the judgment handed down by the Cape High Court on Friday, which relates to the Sexual Offences Act. I was in touch with the Ministry and I've asked Mr. Romano to forward to all of you copies of my letter to the Minister, as well as a copy of the judgment, assuming that you haven't got that. I would think that by now you would, if you had picked up on the matter. It's at this point not clear what the Ministry intends. I'm informed that there have been discussions since Friday within the Ministry, the acting NDPP and the DG and others on this matter. So it's the Ministry is seized with the matter. But I'd like to hear your comments. Quite clearly, we would need to, please let me finish this as well. We would need to correct any anomalies in the law. That's the first thing. The second thing is, Mr. Romano, we need to adopt our budget report. I trust that all members have got copies of it. If you haven't, then I'll ask the staff to distribute those. Honourable members, the Judicial Matters Bill, which we're going to consider, there is a submission by Eskom which I would like you to think about and address me on, which is the whole question of funding of the SIU by a department and then possible yanking of that funding and what happens in that situation. Eskom has put forward a proposal. I'm not sure that it is it solves the problem, but I'd like to hear your views on that matter. Mr. Romano has just handed me a submission by Corruption Watch, which is a letter of support on the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill. As far as apologies are concerned, Prof. Ndabandaba has indicated he's running late. He will join us. Oh, sorry, Prof.
Thanks.
I
was in Kabila.
And the Honourable Shula Shapestole has missed her flight yesterday and will try and join us. I hear interjections, but all right. We are also joined by Advocate Jiba. My apologies, I didn't see you come in. Welcome. Advocate Jiba, your presence here is appreciated. Now, let's begin with sexual offences. Jeffrey, Mr. Swart, Debbie Schaefer. In that order, please. Mr. Schaefer. JJ.
Oh, me. Okay. Chair, look, I think I got your letter was emailed out. I don't know how many members got it, and I think it's a direct course. I mean, I think to say that I have skim read the judgment, I find it completely bizarre. In that it may be that the legislature, that is us as the committee, the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces made a mistake. But what is weird is, well, what is untenable
is that in terms of that judgment, as far as I can see it, certain categories of sexual offences are no longer offences. And it's on the basis of Roman law principles and the fact that the judge felt that the legislature wasn't clear that it intended to be an offence. But I think the correct issue is that hopefully, I mean, the applicant was the provincial director from the Western Cape. I'm not sure, the judgment came out on Friday, so I'm not sure if the acting national director is in a position to respond, and maybe not, because this is you know, what he says is obviously not, is what would be expected is a considered response. I'm not sure if he's in a position, but hopefully there would be an appeal. But however, if there is a lacuna, a gap in the law, that needs to be corrected. You put it in your letter to the minister that that is you know, asking his input and offering the fact that it's being a committee bill. That went off yesterday, so we need to hear what happens with that, but I don't think we can take it much further at this point. But I think the issue is basically what would be, I think, important is that judgment is appealed against, number one, and number two, though, we take steps to rectify any defect in the law as soon as possible, but we need to... we need to give a considered approach, not a rushed approach.
So before I recognize you, advocate Mukhafra, I do apologize. It's one of those days. I also wanted to recognize you. Please forgive me. I apologize most humbly to you. We also have in our midst advocate Mukhafra, head of the SIU. At some point, I'm going to ask Mr. Bassett to also make an input on this particular matter. Mr. Bassett has done a bit of research with reference to previous judgments. And then Advocate Jiba, at some point, both you and Advocate McArthur, if you feel you want to, come in and make an input, you'll be most welcome. Mr. Swart.
Thank you, Chair. I was likewise concerned about the media reports and about this judgment, particularly in view that it's a full bench judgment, three judges. One would clearly need to study the judgment very clearly, and I agree with Honourable JJ that we need a considered discretion. One would have to decide that if there is a loophole, we as as MPs need to take responsibility, but first we need to establish what the facts. I understand there is a conflict in judgment in OFED in respect of two judges, and there are conflicting views on the academic writers as well. But clearly, I was thinking that if there is at the end of the day, and we need to move relatively quickly, I do appreciate what the Honourable JJ says, we mustn't do it in haste. But if there is a loophole or lacuna, I strongly support your view that we need to consider a committee bill like we've done in the past. We did it once before, and we passed that bill in a matter of days, and that was, I think, in the same judgment relating to appeal. So I would support the two-pronged approach. I'm just not sure what the implications would be that if the NPA lodges an appeal to the FCA, can we in the meantime bring amended legislation? What would be the impact of that? But I would strongly support that if the need arises, I want to emphasize that. I'm not sure if the need does arise, but the bringing of urgent amending legislation via a committee bill, which will then expedite it, and we don't need to go through the whole tracking process of Parliament, which would happen if it comes via the Ministry. Thank you, Chair.
Before I recognize you, Mr. Sheikh, just please bear in mind we may be faced with a flood of applications from people who have already been convicted in terms of those 29 offences in the Act. I think that's the other serious consideration that we need to bear in mind.
Chair, and yes, thank you very much for your prompt action in this matter. As you, you know, are aware, I have addressed you on it over the weekend, and thank you for writing to the Minister so quickly. I am likewise concerned. I think it's hugely potentially problematic, and what concerns me most is the fact that it is a three-judge judgment. It's a full bench of the Cape High Court. What does concern me also is looking at the judgment that they quote this very nice Latin principle and J.J. will love so much, nulla poena sine lege, no punishment without a law. And the fact of that is the fact that some offences in the Act are have got specific penalties attached to them and others haven't, I think, is potentially problematic. Now, I agree that we can't, I mean, we cannot afford to appeal. I agree that we should, that the department should appeal, and I trust that they will be doing so. But we cannot afford to take the chance that the appeal does not succeed, and that any actions that are taken between now and then will then also be rendered invalid and appealable, and people will not be able to be charged in the case. So if the appeal does succeed, then I think we're going to be in even bigger trouble. And yes, obviously we must be careful. We need a very, very good opinion and very quickly from the state law advisors on what needs to be done, if anything, but it would appear that something does need to be done. And I would urge that we do it as quickly as possible, because if the court judgment is upheld, you know, ongoing prosecutions and convictions are going to be at risk. Thank you.
Well, it's those very ongoing prosecutions that we have to address. What's happened in the past, we could, I think honourable members who've been here longer than most will know that the courts have rejected retrospective legislation.
So
yes, we do.
The Constitution forbids it, so we can't, punishment cannot be retrospectively
applied.
You have to know at the time that commission is intent that punishment has to exist.
Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, yes, there are. We've done a bit of research. The Western Cape High Court is an appeal to three judges. The judgment in the Free State is a review judgment before two judgments. That's S versus Boy, and S versus Boy is the way we would like to see it. But it is tricky. There does seem to be two schools of thought. Maybe I can just refer to one of the respected authors on criminal law, Snowman. Let me just quote from one of his books. If a statutory provision creates a criminal norm only, but remains silent on the criminal sanction, the punishment is simply at the court's discretion. That is, the court itself can decide what punishment to impose. So I've got a document here. Perhaps I should make it available. And he goes on to say further. If the legislature creates a crime, it should, in order to best comply with the principle of legality, also set out the punishment for the crime. This limits the possibility of an unusual, cruel, or arbitrary punishment being imposed. Emphasis. If the legislature creates an offence but omits to specify the punishment, then the punishment is in the discretion of the court. So we have it there, and I think it's also in Virtue or one of the other writers, I'm not too sure about it, but this is in black and white before me, so that is there. So there is a difference of opinion, and where we are in the department, we are still waiting for counsel's advice. Our office of the Chief Litigation Office in our national office has been in contact with the Director of Public Prosecutions in Cape Town, and they have spoken. As far as I'm aware, counsel has been appointed. Counsel was having a look last night and is going to give us advice sometime today on what's going to happen, the best way to proceed. I should imagine it will be an appeal. I don't know whether there's any other route to go, but we're still waiting for the outcome of counsel's advice. And I also have a feeling, I can't be quite sure, we're still waiting for the advice, but I'm sure the minister will be joined in whatever goes ahead. So it is being taken care of. I'm not too sure whether there's anything else that I can say at this point. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Bassett.
Perhaps if I may come in again. I think we need to at least start having a look at what amendments might be required. I've requested my colleagues in Pretoria to start that, and they're working on it as we speak. In, in the event of the committee wanting us, we are there to assist.
Excellent. Yeah, I was going to ask that anyway. So I'm grateful that you've taken the initiative and catching up.
Thank you, Chairperson. You know, from informal discussions that we were having over the weekend, really, I must say that we're all up in arms against this judgment, actually. There is a strong feeling that we really need to, as my colleague is saying, but we're just waiting for the official opinion from council. There's a strong feeling that, and a strong view that we need to take it up. We can't just leave it lying as it is, because as you said, there are consequences if you don't take this matter up at all. But as my colleague has said, the problem is we don't have the official, legal opinion as yet. But I'm sure it will be there very soon.
Thank you very much. Jeffrey, followed by Chair.
Okay, I don't think we can take it much further, but I think the issue would be it is urgent, and I think we should then ask for a report. I don't know whether it should be from the NPA or the department, maybe would be better, because they can combine the whole approach. But can we get the report in a week's time?
Clarity, is it a report on what to give further feedback on what I've done today?
I think Mr. Bassett refers to a document. It would be useful to see that document, and it would also be useful to get that document into the public domain. I don't know what form the document takes. I don't know whether the department will be preparing a press statement, but I think that would be important. References to the Free State judgment, particularly. But it would be useful. Can we have that information circulated for our own interest? And I think our proposal, Chair, from the committee to the ministry. I mean, it could also be to the NPA, but the NPA was the appellant in the case. But is that there's also something done to give the other side in the media, because it does seem to be another side. What baffles me is Chair, the pressure. I mean, you know, usually you've got to be careful about procedure when people's rights are affected. I cannot fathom, and there's no mention that I can find of it in the judgment, of how the accused in the criminal case's rights were affected by this. I mean, you know it's a crime. Even if it's a technicality of there's no offence listed, I mean, you haven't been prejudiced. The prejudice is when you don't know it's a crime, but everybody, it's there in the act. So anyway, Chair, I think the issue, can Mr. Bassett now circulate, or as soon as possible after the meeting, circulate his information? We suggest that the NPA and or the ministry put some of this information into the public domain in the form of a press statement or press briefing. But the report, Chair, in a week's time, would be the progress on the appeal of the Prince judgment, and a response from the department on amendments to the Sexual Offences Act, which you are proposing in your letter to the minister, could be a committee bill, which would be faster, because it doesn't have to go through the cabinet process.
Okay. Yes, Ms. Schaefer, followed by Ms. Majaki.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just on the issue of virtual, it's actually completely contradicting Snyder, because he specifically quoted in the Act, in the judgment as follows: punishment is an integral part of the concept of a crime. Without the liability to punishment, there would be no distinction between penal and non-penal law. Thus, it follows that to render any act criminal in our law, there must be some punishment affixed to the commission of the act. And where no law exists affecting such punishment, there is no crime in law. So, I mean, I think the fact that those two eminent academics are both contradicting each other indicates the fact that we cannot afford to take a chance that it will definitely be overturned on appeal. So I support the suggestion that we get a report in a week as to what we need to do to ensure that there is no doubt.
As I said, there seem to be two schools of thought. I've got a feeling that it might be virtual. That's also on the side of Stamen.
These are unintended consequences of our own democracy, where you find that our own laws actually manages to allow criminals to manage to actually challenge this. I do support the notion that punishment lies in the discretion of the court, and maybe this is what is happening, but at the same time support the idea that you need to have the Sexual Offences Amendment Bill as soon as possible. because this really is going to be taking away gains that have actually been made in terms of punishment of the perpetrators. We will get a backlash from even civil society, let alone the fact that, like you've indicated, Chair, we may actually have people who've been convicted already coming back to us.
Grateful to you for making your views known. And Mr. Bassett, we'll expect those documents from you as we've requested, and then we'll take it from there. Advocate Jiba, I think you've heard the views of the members. They feel very strongly that there should be an appeal, but we'll wait for this Chief State Litigator's opinion, and we trust that he agrees with us. Or she. All right. That deals with that. I think let's deal with... Do it tomorrow. All right. Mr. Romano is suggesting, honorable members, that the budget report be adopted tomorrow. Will that be okay, Mr. Jeffrey?
Yes, yeah, I was going to ask for that. I mean, we got it dated today,
yes,
and we got it this morning before we came to the meeting, so we can't deal with it.
All right, fine. Okay. In which case, then, judicial matters. I want you to address me on Telkom's submission. I'm sorry. Wrong call, yes. honorable members, I assume you have read Eskom's comments, in which case I'd like you to address me on that, Mr. Jeffrey.
Yes, thanks. I mean, the Eskom submission is very brief, but it's the issue of the SIUB granted permission to charge and recover fees and expenses. They wanted it in matters initiated by the state institution and not matters which the SIU initiated the investigation. And secondly, the relationship should be managed in terms of the contract which provides for the management of the process, etc. And they effectively propose an amendment to Section 4, which is, I suppose you could put as a condition on the charging and recovering of fees and expenses from a state institution. They want the words "in terms of the service level agreement concluded between the institution and the SIU," that, you know, there should be agreement between the SIU and the state institution before any costs have been incurred. Now, Chair, I don't know if Eskom wants to come here. I mean, this is meant to be the day of the public hearing. I think they go too far. I mean, my own, having looked at it and thought about it, I think Eskom go too far. But my worry is that, because if you, effectively, this is going to be charges, the state institution being investigated have to agree on, there has to be an agreement reached between the SIU and that institution. Now, remembering that it's the SIU get involved through presidential proclamations, so it's not as if they're just sort of from a free-floating lone ranger looking for something to do, and then it's okay, let's go for that institution and investigate them, and, you know, here we are, municipality of Twillendam, we've investigated you. These officials have already said the bill. It's not like that. It's presidential proclamation. But my concern, though, is that the way it is worded, it does, and I think the SIU members may recall, I did raise it particularly with local government. It's fairly, you may recover the expenses, but what happens if the institution can't pay? And I do think it is a worry. It is, as it's worded at the moment, left up to the goodwill of the SIU, and that's what I'm worried about. Now, a body like ESCOM presumably would have the money, but if you're investigating, which you very often do, a local authority, a municipality, which because of for the very reasons why you're conducting the investigation, it's got no money, and you then present them with a bill. If they have to pay that bill, it's going to affect property service delivery, the ability to buy refuse removal trucks or other capital goods and so on. So I think we need to get a response, Chair, from the SIU, the MPA, on that concern. A possible solution would be to put in a role for Treasury, because effectively it's Treasury that has to bail out the SIU if you don't recover enough money, if you don't make enough money, and it's Treasury that would have to bail out whatever state institution you are presenting the bill to if they can't pay. So thinking about it, I don't think what ESCOM proposes is correct, because it gives the state institution effectively a veto. And they may have sensitivities over the whole SIU investigation, because, hey, you're investigating them. So I don't think that is correct. But I do worry about it being left as it is at the moment in the bill, effectively, as I would say, up to the goodwill of the SIU. And a solution may be to put in a requirement of consultation with Treasury. I'm not quite sure who, whether it should be the Accountant General, whether it should be the Director General of Justice of what's called Treasury, who could delegate it down, whether it should be an in-consultation or an after-consultation. But to my mind, Chair, that's the sort of way to go, or I would think that suggests that's the way to go. And I would be interested in the response from the SIU, and that we then should maybe also get, if there is sort of broader agreement from the committee, maybe an input from Treasury as to the structuring. In terms of time, Chair, we've got two windows for legislation this term. We've got the sum stuff next week in plenary, which I think it unless we can resolve this easily and quickly now, this bill won't be ready. The second slot then is the 14th of June, which still completes it, which I would think we could make. But Chair, in short then, my concern is that I don't agree with the ESCOM submission, because it gives the state institution effectively a veto. I'm worried about the bill as it stands, that it's left to the goodwill of the SIU, and the solution may be a requirement for a consultation with Treasury, who, in a sense, have to carry the can, whichever way it goes. Bail SIU out, bail out the state institution that has got this hefty bill from the SIU. And then it's a question of the mechanisms for that.
I've got Mr. Swart, followed by Ms. Dean-Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I think the main concern expressed by the SIU was exactly the point of department frustrating the investigations by saying that there's a lack of funding, and that's the whole purpose of this legislation. So I feel strongly that this submission by ESCOM goes too far, and we can't have a situation where institutions that are investigated, where the SIU initiates the investigation, can frustrate that investigation through lack of funds, and that was specifically pointed out as a problem. So I understood the model to be along the lines of the Auditor General. Now, clearly the Auditor General's audits would be built into your budget every year, where a local government would know that's what the budget's going to be, but they wouldn't know that they are going to be investigated. So it is a problem. So I tend to agree with JJ that Treasury needs to give us some guidance as a way forward. But I want to emphasize the point that we can't have funding constraints inhibiting the SIU's work, and that we all are in agreement. That's why we want to pass this urgently. So we need to find a way of dealing with that, but I don't agree with the submission that it should only be in respect of investigations initiated by the state institution. That cannot be so, and that would lead to a very serious frustration of the SIU's work, we all agree they need additional capacities. It's absolutely unacceptable that they are struggling with capacity when they can recover money. It's like it's such a conundrum, because they don't have the capacity to do the work, but if they do the work, they'll recover money. They can recover billions of rand. So it's logical, common sense to me. Give them as much resources as possible to recover the money. Thank you, Chair.
Very good. The Honourable Steve Smith.
Chair, yes, it seems to me that ESCOM is chancing its arm, having been, were they not, the institution that first spotted the fact that there was no provision in the law for cost recovery. They very cleverly pointed that out. And that is the reason why we are amending. But they now, I do think, with respect, chancing their arm, because they're suggesting that it is only when an investigation is done on request from the state institution. But costs may be recovered, and then in terms of a service level agreement, so they want to negotiate this whole thing. That was not the intention. SIU functions by a presidential proclamation. It cannot only be, if I'm reading this correctly, on request from the state institution. And as for a solution, I would certainly go with what the Honourable Jeffrey suggests. Let's see what the Treasury says, and let's see what we can build in.
Advocate Mukak, Jeffrey before.
No, I was going to say, can we?
I'm not an advocate Mukak. Before you come in, have you actually had sight of Eskom's comment?
Mm-hmm.
Do you wish to address us?
Yes.
Please.
Well, I agree with the concerns that have been raised here on the table, and we think about it, especially around. Service level agreements, whether there should be a negotiation thing, because we think that our work through a proclamation and the frustrations that we have been receiving, where departments would be saying we don't have the money and we don't agree up front as to how much the investigation will cost, and also with the concerns that we see too much in the department and we care cost as we're sitting in there as we find what we need to find. I will then give to Gerard, because he had a plan that he should, as head of LIGA, he should then address the meeting on this aspect.
Sorry, it's Gerard. Gerard Fasalchi. Thank you, Mr.
Fasalchi. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, thank you. I will build up towards dealing with the issue raised by the Honourable Mr. Jeffrey, but I think perhaps it's wise just to look at a bit of background to where this issue comes from. The history is quite obvious that previously, in the previous 8 years or whatever, to complement its funding, the SIU did enter into these SLAs with various state institutions. And what Eskom is suggesting here was ultimately what developed through these SLAs and what was contained in them. Primarily, they're asking that there must be an SLA, that the investigation must be initiated by the state institution, that there must be an actual agreement as to cost beforehand. Mm-hmm. Now, we dealt with these issues or asked an opinion on this exact point mm-hmm. from Chaplin SC when the issue of the funding came up. And he expressed some very, very strong views as to this particular point. In fact, he was of the view that that would be against the purpose of the Act.
Oh.
It would affect the transparency and independence of the SIU if it is involved in a situation where it's dependent on a funding model which is contractually of nature, which would place the state institution in a position to dictate terms and create obligations for the SIU as to what focus areas they should deal with in their investigation, when and how they should report, and if, and this I can tell you as a fact, they would withhold funds if reporting is not done in a manner as they wish, etc. So Jaspersen was kind of very strongly in saying that this is a type of SLA which creates a tension between the purpose of the Act and the actual work of the SIU. In fact, goes a lot further. He actually says that the proclamation that demands this would actually be able to realize the provisions of the Act. So certainly we agree with some of the views that have been expressed by the Honourable Committee members that ESCOM does go way too far with this requirement, that it's not the spirit of the Act. It was a necessary evil in the past, which we believe will no longer be an evil if this bill is actually passed. We believe that there are sufficient safeguards in Section 41 of the Constitution on cooperative governance, as well as in the Intergovernmental Relations Act and the protocols envisaged by that Act, to ensure that the SIU would not ride roughshod over state institutions, but would enter into proper arrangements with them regarding the issues that they've raised, which would fall short of an actual SLA, but would just rationalize the sort of work that we talk about.
The Office of Government and Research.
The Intergovernmental Relations Act.
Yes.
What we feel is I've dealt with the issue of creating an SLA where the department determines the focus areas, deals with the reporting mechanism, and in fact creates the wrong perceptions. We also have a serious problem with the issue, when I say wrong perceptions, the perception of lack of objectivity. We also have a serious problem with the issue of who initiates the investigation. It can come through a presidential proclamation. As was correctly pointed out, we are instructed to do an investigation. The idea of a state institution initiating the investigation themselves, and only then that the Act kicks in, is foreign to the whole rationale behind the Act. Just dealing specifically with the issue raised by the Honourable Mr. Jeffrey about the role of National Treasury. We have looked at this issue, and the first point, of course, that is important here is that the wording in the JMA bill uses the word may charge the fees. Now, I hear the point quite clearly that it's the issue of the dependence on the goodwill of the SIU. It is important to remember that the SIU, as currently set up, is not likely to be fully dependent on these charged fees for its income. It still gets a significant grant from government, so it's not unforeseeable that the SIU would only charge for some of its investigations, and that in instances where an institution such as a municipality is unable to pay, that investigation could be done without charge. But perhaps it is a bit unstructured to have something as open as that and open to the goodwill of the SIU. I want to refer this committee to the Public Audit Act, number 25 of 2004, which regulates the situation of audit fees levied by the Auditor General of South Africa. And in particular, section 23, 4, 5, and 6, where it says, if an auditee defaults on the payment of audit fees, the Auditor General must promptly notify the National Treasury, and when applicable, the relevant provincial treasury. 5, the National Treasury or the relevant provincial treasury, as may be appropriate, may, after consulting the Auditor General, direct that audit fees recoverable from an auditee which is not a national or provincial department be defrayed from a vote on the national or a provincial budget identified by the relevant treasury. 6, if the audit fee exceeds 1%, etc., etc. So it creates a situation where a fee which cannot be paid by a state institution could effectively become a charge against the National Revenue Fund. So, just on one last aspect that I want to point out, one of the other issues raised by ESCOM in their letter relates to them suggesting that there should be upfront agreement as to the charges and rates, etc. In the bill, there is provision for the minister to determine rates or maximum rates to be charged. I believe, well, in my submission, that sufficiently deals with the risks associated with overcharging of poor state institutions.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Jeffrey. Yeah, thanks. Look, just responding to this, Sathi, first of all, let's just cut to the chase. I don't think we need to debate the issue of whether there should be a service level agreement or not, whether the, we don't want that in the bill. We don't want the state institution to have any power to frustrate the investigation in whatever. So that is basically out. I don't think we need to debate that any further. The issue is, as you say, and we accept it's a may, not a must, but as you repeat what I said, it is after the goodwill of the SIU. You say that there are safeguards in, I think, was it Chapter 3, the Intergovernmental Relations Chapter and the Intergovernmental Relations Act. What are those safeguards?
Are they real?
Because to my mind, there's a whole lot of broad principles in the Constitution and in the Act. Nothing specific. And there's lots of room for legal disputes that we could avoid if we make it a clearer procedure in the Act. The reference to the Public Audit Act, two problems. I mean, one, Mr. Swart raised the point already that audits are foreseen. And you've got a general idea of the cost. SIU investigations are not foreseen. You don't budget for crimes that are going to be committed and the need to investigate those crimes, whereas you do budget for an audit. And you might find in the case of a small-scale municipality that this issue of defraying against their budget, well, they don't, if you defray against their budget, well, they're going to have nothing for the next 10 years. Their budget is so small. So I don't think that is an adequate solution. I think in those cases of small-scale municipalities, you probably shouldn't be charging. Those are my responses, or my concerns in response to Mr. Pasaki. In short, I don't think that... I think there seems to be a recognition of the potential problem. I don't think the government relations section of the Constitution or the Act provides a safeguard. I think we need to do so in this bill. And we need to do it in such a way that it does not hamper the SIU, does not give any right to the state body that's being investigated, or rights or opportunities for the state body being investigated to delay the investigation. So I come back to the proposal of saying a in consultation or after consultation, so you keep the wording that's there, that you may levy, but it is in or after consultation with national treasury. So that's the principle of the issue. If there's agreement on the principle, one would then have to look at the wording. And I suppose there is a big difference between in or after consultation. And remembering this is only about not stopping, we need to also make it quite clear that it doesn't stop your work. Mm-hmm. It's really just on the issue of charging the state institution and recovering money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, Advocate Lumisa.
Chairperson, thank you very much. And I apologize for asking this question from a point of ignorance. Because I think I missed out on the time when the bill was presented to me. The SIU, in my understanding, does an investigation at the request of the President through a proclamation. But at the same time, is it not a standing institution that has personnel that are there in order to act when called upon by the President to do the investigation? If that is the case, why should it act as if it is a private institution that will do its work on the basis of fees to be charged and so on. Why is it not an institution like the NPA or like the police for that matter, who are there in order to combat crime? Yeah, it is. I apologize. If I could be clarified on that, maybe I could be some use.
So the means if the institution that is funded by the state, it's got a state budget for a specific financial year. In terms of the Act, I don't think the SAU can actually foresee the amount of proclamations that is going to be issued by the President in terms of the Act. So, and also the volume of the work that needs to be done in terms of a specific proclamation. So the effect is usually that the budget of the SAU is quickly exceeded due to the fact that many investigations are referred to the SIU. And the reason for this request for the amendment is to provide that the budget can, through certain funds that's obtained from the investigating agency, will more or less ensure that they always have sufficient funds to investigate the matter during a specific financial year.
How is that different from the work of the NPA and other police services?
Well,
how do they anticipate the amount?
It's very difficult, and that is why it's on a user pays principle. So while the President does sign a proclamation authorizing them to conduct an investigation, the law also then says they would need to sit down with the organ of state that they are investigating and reach an agreement as to how that organ of state pays for the investigation. And that is where we are now. You may find yourself in a situation where 1 week within the investigation, that organ of state, because certain people are being exposed, exercises a veto and yanks the funding for that investigation. Now, these are all the issues that members are trying to address now, this morning.
Thank you, Chair, Honourable Members. It's all about capacity and all about the size of the contribution that the SIU can make. You can do a basic assessment of what the needs are to run the organization, and that is the baseline budget. We've had that discussion with National Treasury several times. They work on a certain baseline, and that is what we get from Treasury. But then when we get additional work, we need additional funds to bring in additional resources to deal with those matters. So the model that we're talking about here allows us to grow and shrink according to the needs at the time of the for the organization. So it's I suppose in the case of the NPA or in the police, SAPS, many years of statistics can give you a specifically accurate need for resources in your organization. In our environment, the need for resources vary from year to year, and the capacity has to grow and shrink. This kind of funding model would allow for that way of working.
The resources would mean human resources as well, outside of the unit itself, or what kind of resources are they starting?
Well, Chair, members, yes, resources means exactly that. Resources means the money to engage human resources to bring in. We deal almost entirely with human resources when we operate. That is by far our greatest cost factor, and that is the human resources and the skills required for specific investigations that is funded through this process.
We outsource in resources, yeah.
We insource. We in the past have never outsourced any of our work. What we do is we insource capacity, additional capacity. So we bring people in on a service provider basis.
So I don't understand. If they outsource, meaning you engage the services of people outside of the unit in order to help the unit do the work.
Well, he describes that as insourcing.
Outsourcing.
No. Outsourcing means that the investigation is being conducted by an outside body.
Isn't that what he's saying?
No, he's not saying. He's saying that they are contracted to do so on behalf of the SIU and under their control and supervision.
Yes, indeed. We, if I want to distinguish between the two, if we outsource, is we will take a project and give it to KPMG or Deloitte or whatever, and say, listen, you deal with this and then give us a report afterwards. We don't operate on that model. We would rather engage people who work for entities such as that and appoint them on either a contract basis or on a secondment basis as members of our organization, and then they do those investigations in our organization under our control. That's what we call an insourcing model.
Ms. Mitchell.
Thanks,
Chair.
I think when you had a trading with SIU.
Please put on your mic.
When we had engagement with you previously, the area that we also commented about was the use of consultants. I want to go back to the issue of capacity. We were quite concerned about the fact that excessive, more than 50% of personnel was consultant. I'm not sure about the percentage, one third, yes. What I think also needs to be done, Chair, is for personnel of SIU to actually be assessed so that you could try and almost bring a balance, because the resources are there, but for some reason it's believed that the resources are not enough for running this institution. And it may therefore make things easier should you actually maybe assess and find that instead of maybe having consultants, you can have more staff members, because your responsibility is almost like other institutions like the public protector. Mm-hmm. And state agencies don't pay the public protector to investigate it. And they also do very large scale investigations. If you just think of the arms deal, for example. So for now, I think I'm not actually saying yes or no to what is being proposed, but I'm thinking where we need to begin is to really look at the structure, the personnel structure of the SIU in relation to the kind of resources that the state is actually putting into this institution, and then see how that can actually either manage to help the SIU to perform effectively or ineffectively. And then we can then thereafter then look at what would be the best possible way of actually doing it. And indeed, the problem is, if you have to be getting money from government departments, you will experience problems that have already been articulated now. The more independent you are, the better. So that when you're saying we're coming to investigate, there isn't anything that's going to actually become an obstacle. Thank you, Chair.
Although, in fairness to the SIU, and without engaging in a debate with you, the difference between the SIU and the public protector is that the SIU brings money back to the state. It recovers.
Yeah.
And that's a huge difference.
I acknowledge, Chair, that is very good in comparison to public protector, but probably in terms of operations, can we learn from what we're doing?
All right. First, Mr. Swart, and then Mr. Jeffrey.
Chair, I just want to understand the suggestion about the Auditor General's, the reference to that act, the section in the Public Audit Act that states that costs can be defrayed. So in the case of an audit at a local government level where the audit cannot be paid for, the costs can be defrayed from humans, local governments, can be defrayed from national treasury, and the suggestion is possibly to put something in along the same lines. So it's not to be defrayed from the local government, which would then address Mr. Jeffrey's concern about local governments not being able to pay for the audit. And then just on the issue of national treasury, I think we raised this in our previous discussion, whether there had been consultation at all with national treasury on the bill. I don't see it in the back, but clearly I think we are looking in, as Mr. Jeffrey indicated, to looking at that possibility of putting those words in, that there is a requirement to consult with National Treasury. But firstly, was there a consultation with them on the implications of the present draft? Secondly, if we were to put in the words in or after consultation, understanding the huge difference between that, what would the implication of that be, bearing in mind that the President issues the proclamation? Would it cause a delay at all in your work? And could Treasury itself not then block you, bearing in mind the financial constraints that Treasury is reminding all departments have a haircut, cut your costs, and they then could say, no, you can't go ahead. This department cannot afford what you're doing. And in words then, Treasury frustrating your work. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, look, when we had the presentation on the bill and to some extent in the budget hearing, I mean, we were told by the SIU that the reason they didn't get more money from Treasury is because there was an expectation that this legislation would be passed, so that they would be able to, as they have been doing in the past, recover some money from some of the state bodies that are able to pay. And the whole reason for the bill is the court case which found that was unconstitutional, or that there wasn't the legislative authority to do that. So that's why we've got the bill. So I think I'd suggest we focus on where we are. But now I think the bottom line is then that should the SIU enjoy a broad power to be able to charge for its investigations, or should there be some kind of requirement on Treasury, who control the overall purse strings, to give an input? I don't really see. I don't see Mr. Swart's concern about the Treasury stopping an investigation. I mean, nothing would stop an investigation. I mean, if there isn't any money for you to charge for it, you will have to conduct it as you have been doing anyway for a number of your investigations. You will have to conduct it on your own. So it's not as if the President has said, investigate, here's a proclamation, SIU investigate, you must investigate. It's the question of, is this body, does it have enough money to actually pay you for what you've done? That's the question, and who determines whether they've got enough money? Currently, in terms of the bill, it is up to the SIU to say, okay, we think this body, state body, has enough money, and we're going to charge them, and if they won't pay it in terms of this act, we can then sue them, whatever. Take them to court for recovery of that money. And that's the concern. And I think the proposal that I'm then making is a requirement on a consultation with Treasury as to whether they can be charged or not. So it's not a question of whether to investigate. So, Chair, that's the issue. I don't know how much the SIU have thought about this. I mean, I'm not getting any... Mr. Pasaki is mandated to speak on their behalf. I'm not getting any positive response from them. I don't know, so maybe they need more time, but we don't want to give them much time because you want this bill. I don't know, Chair, through you, whether the officials from the department, Mr. Robertson, Mr. Bassett, or Mr. DeLange, are maybe sitting there for some other reason, whether
comment to say. I don't know whether we should then approach the Minister of Finance to say, please give us a response and a possible wording. But I'd suggest, Chair, if you don't have anything more to say, that can the departmental officials give a response, give us their views?
Okay,
then
after that.
Chairperson, I was quiet because I was waiting for our acting head to respond to the issue of the staff complement, which he will do in the near future. We hear the point that is made, and I think it makes eminent sense. We haven't actually thought about that long and hard, but it makes so much sense that we now, in very brief deliberations here, are in agreement with that. There could be value in a requirement of, and we suggest after consultation with NT. It's always easier. The in consultation could lead to the frustration that the Honourable Mrs. White referred to earlier. So, I think from our side, adding wording to the effect after consultation with NT would not frustrate the objects of the call.
Well, inserting the word after consultation with is probably the way to go. Also in the Act, in Section 2.2, if certain provincial institutions need to be instituted, there's a requisite that the Premier's consent be obtained. So there is consultation regarding the issue of information, so that can probably be extended to cover service level agreements. I need to make some kind of proposal maybe to the effect that if the government institutions cannot pay this, can we not maybe impose an obligation on National Treasury to pay these funds out of the National Revenue Fund to say in the Act? Ensure that we can recover it. It's going to be a problem, I know. It's going to change the
money bill.
And
then also the issue is that the SIU do get a budget here. So they are funded. They're not entirely, I think the Auditor General is entirely self-generating. They get, but because it's a different animal, you can't compare them. This was just the issue of the practice where they were able to recover some money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if they're going to start charging everybody for everything that they
sure.
do. So I think, Chair, that is out. I mean, look, we then, there's a bit of a more, after pushing, more positive response from the SIU and Mr. Roberts' earlier point. I mean, obviously there would need to be where the matter is coming from a provincial budget, so it would be a provincial department. There would need to be a consultation with, that consultation would not need to be with National Treasury, but with local Treasury.
Sure.
I'm not sure how you consult with Treasury, whether it has to be the Director General or the HOD, a Director General National, HOD Provincial, but you'd have to look at that wording, but presumably you can't put in a consultation with Treasury, because what is Treasury? Who? You phone the switchboard operator and say, can I? And But Chair, I don't know if there's much more than anyone wants to say. Maybe we should leave it to SIU, the officials, to go away, consult with Treasury on a wording and come back to us as soon as possible.
Ms. Chandler?
Thanks, Chair. I agree with everything that's been said. We do need to be careful that this is not an unlimited, you can't expect any department or state institution just to have a bottomless pit of expenses. I mean, there's got to be some kind of, now whether after consultation will be sufficient safeguard, I'm not sure, but there does need to be some appreciation for the fact that they can't just go and run up whatever cost they feel like and expect substance to come from somewhere.
I think on that point, the difference, though, the safeguard is that it is
not the Lone Ranger SIU deciding we're going to investigate the city of Cape Town, but it is a presidential proclamation. So,
yeah. Yes, Steve.
I see it's also to recover funds for conducting civil proceedings. Now, clearly, you would that you'd recover in the process is it of the civil litigation. Are you talking about attorney and client costs there as opposed to party and party costs, or where that civil proceeding is against the person that's stolen the money? What is envisaged there? Thanks.
Honourable Chair, members, what's envisaged there is in line with the other amendments that deal with civil litigation in the name of the state institution. If there are legal costs incurred in the process of the civil litigation conducted in the name of the state institution, that would be part of the costs incurred and that could be recovered from them. We obviously do not foresee that happening in many instances. Quite frankly, I know it's not the point we're debating at the moment, but we would see that as the exception, where the SIU would actually litigate on behalf of the state institution, because it's primarily their prerogative and duty to institute the civil litigation, and it would be in those instances where there's a refusal or a laxity or whatever to do so. So that is included for those limited number of instances where there are costs associated with civil litigation that we would also be able to recover that as part of the cost of the investigation.
And will you not get the time?
Well, you know, sometimes you get cross order even if you win on cross order against you on some issues. And also it's not always possible to recover the costs from the other party even if you win the case.
If I may add, just to allay the fears, that we are all mindful of the fact that sometimes if you outsource, as opposed to insourcing, that they, when you do the civil matters, then if you outsource for insource in the civil matter, you will have to pay counsel, you will have to pay for cost incurred, postponement, and so forth. But what we're doing at the moment is in line with the capacity and the staff that we have, as opposed to getting people from outside to get inside. We are capacitating the ones that are inside. And one of the projects that is going on right now, which is pressing and urgent, is capacitating the lawyer space to enable them to be able to take these matters as members of SIU to the tribunal as well as to other places. So in terms of cost for legal services, they will be employed. They would not have they will not be charging extra fees for doing such work. It will only be in instances where there will be court ordered and somebody to pay something out of the court order. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there's one thing that worried me a lot when I read this bill, and that is the fact that something that was raised by the Accountant General last year. We're passing all these pieces of legislation, but very often there are existing laws in place that could be used to deal with these issues. Now, I mean, the issue, half the problem why we're having to pass this is because accounting officers are not cooperating. Surely that's a contravention of the MFMA, and that's exactly what he was saying last year, that the accounting officers are not being held responsible by their political superiors for doing their job. Now, if an accounting officer is refusing to cooperate with the SIU in an investigation, surely that constitutes an offence in terms of the MFMA. So we're busy here creating yet more legislation to deal with something that already is dealt with. Now, I mean, I don't know whether we can do anything here, but what crossed my mind is whether we should actually say in this bill, if an accounting officer does not comply with their responsibilities, and if they do obstruct action being taken by the SIU, they should be personally responsible for those legal costs.
Yeah, that's a different issue, really. I mean, in terms of it's not... the issue in the bill was around SIU being able to recover funds. Okay, not around the performance of officials. So that might be something they want to come with later as an amendment. But Chair, I'd made a proposal that then the SIU and there seems to be
can I put it in terms of agreement in principle with the idea? I think we could go along with an after consultation, unless anybody else feels we should change it. That you need to make a distinction between the provincial and the national level. It's not a one-size-fits-all in terms of treasury. You need to look at who is the consultation with. Is it with the accountant general? Is it with DG? At provincial level, I don't know if they have accountants general, but have a look at that. And it would then be for the SIU, the who's working in Mr. Robertson, Mr. Bassett? What is Mr. Robertson?
Well, both of us, we were together.
You know, and then for Mr. Robertson, Mr. Bassett, to consult with your counterparts in Treasury on the wording as well. And then to come back to us as soon as possible, which chair, if we want, you want the bill? This afternoon? No, I mean, I think it's, look, I think we're quite clearly not going to get this put into the window for next week, but then, so we go for the 14th, but ASAP, I would say, next week.
Yeah, because we have constraints too, and we're trying to fit in debating this bill in the National Assembly on the 14th. We're not trying to put too much stress and pressure on you. But at the same time, we want you to understand the logistics.
Chair, from our side, we can only appreciate the pressure.
Okay.
This sort of guy. Thank you.
All right.
All
right.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Thanks to all. Okay. Now, what do we have next?
Yeah. Maybe you could just, in terms of getting this bill ready to vote on.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding, and maybe maybe you should ask the question of the committee whether there's any other section of the bill that they feel they want to, they don't like.
They don't like.
Otherwise, can we assume that we agree with the bill? Except this section.
Well, as I understand it, once Mrs. Roberts and Bassett, the SIU and Treasury have sat down and have sorted themselves out and come back to us with an appropriate response, then we're good to go.
Mm. I think so. The other questions that arose for me were answered by Mrs. Roberts at our last week.
Okay. So my understanding that sometime next week we'll be formally considering this bill and finalizing it. And I'm being very optimistic that SIU, Mrs. Roberts, and Bassett and Treasury will reach an accord before next week. Yes. Well, apparently it's praise. It's praise, but read it, Mr. Bassett, and if there's anything there. We only got it this morning, too, so we haven't had time to read it. It's something from this new body called Corruption Watch. So, that being the case.
They did generally, I read it. Generally, they were in support of everything, and they were sort of saying to the committee, don't change anything. The only thing that they wanted that I could find, which is on this particular section that we're dealing with, is that they wanted the fees recoverable to go directly to SIU, which is my understanding the intention anyway of the whole bill. And I think that they, I mean, it's something I think to put out in the open, where you say the SIU may, the current wording, which we're not disputing, the SIU may recover fees and whatever, it means you recover, you get it. So I don't think one needs to say anything more around, they say we propose that the proposed amendment which would allow the SIU to recover fees and expenses from the state institution goes directly to funding for the SIU. I think it's already what it says.
Okay.
So I don't think there was anything in there.
All right. Is there any more I forget you that? No?
No, except that I just want to report that as far as the proposal
insofar as the NPA amendment bill are concerned, I have raised them with the Minister of Justice, and then I have given him a memorandum which I requested to meet him.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
The last amendment on the judicial matters amendment, but clause 10, Mr. Rutherford.
No, I know which clause it is, but it's a question of there wasn't anything, any changes we meant to make to the clause.
If you recall, if I can remind the Chairperson, in the last meeting that we had, there were issues that I raised with regard to the location, proper location of social investigators in the National Prosecuting Authority. And I made an undertaking that I will meet with the police, which I've done, and I've subsequently submitted a memo to the Minister of Justice, which she is looking.
Chair, sorry, my problem is I vaguely remember, but not entirely. But it was just to get clarity, is Advocate Jiba, is there an issue of further amendments to this bill? Or is it around the implementation of the bill?
Yeah, that memo, is it going to hold us back?
Depending, Chairperson, on how the Minister sees it, you know, the point that I am trying to make to the Minister, in fact, to the House at large, that, you know, when we make these amendments, we must be cognizant of why we have why we find ourselves in a particular position before. And I've given background as to why now we're doing this amendment. So it might hold you back, not in so far only as those provisions are concerned, not into the whole, necessarily to the whole bill. But in so far, because that has got far-reaching consequences. If we are to say that the NPA must now further conduct financial investigations, that is something else. At some point in time, we'll need to advertise positions now for investigators in the NPA, and that is just what I'm saying cannot be right, because that was done away with by the law.
Mr. Holomisa, and then Mr. Jeffrey.
Chairperson, I hear what Shiva is saying, but this bill is already before this committee, and any amendments that will be affected will have to be affected by us. I don't know now whether the advocate has taken her proposals to the minister. Is it maybe because she still wants to have an agreement with the minister before they are tabled to us? Or what? Because normally officials would come to us having agreed on what they believe ought to be amended in their amendment bill. But maybe, as I'm speaking, I'm thinking that in effect what she's saying is that she is just warning us that there might be amendments that they want to propose, but she still has to consult the minister. But I'm just pointing making the point here that any amendments that have to be made, of course, have to be agreed to by this committee, so they also be brought to us. But if that's the route now that is going to, that amendment proposed is going to take.
All right, Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, I mean, my problem is I can't remember, unfortunately, I can't remember what the issue was on this point in the briefing. Maybe I'd switched off somewhere along the line. And Chair, I don't have access to, Parliament hasn't given me access to the PMG minutes. I can't check on their minutes what was discussed, and we're still not adopting any minutes, so I don't know what it was. But it basically, I think, Chair, we need to be clear, and I hear my colleague at the Parliament says, and he's correct in terms of if you look at on page 10 of the bill, the memorandum, page 3, departments, bodies, persons consulted, NPA is there. Although I do think we need to be sympathetic that Advocate Jiba, as acting NDPP, was not there, and she has a responsibility and obviously wants to ensure that the right thing is done. But having said that, we need to know, are there likely to be amendments that the NPA wants to propose? Your sections are section 9 and 10. Are there going to be amendments we want to propose? What are those amendments? And if it need be, because we don't want to delay the bill to the SIU, and we've done it, I mean, it's what generally happens with judicial matters, it was a controversial section, then we'll excise those sections and basically reject them in the bill. Either, I don't know what happened before, Mr. Bassett, through you, Chair, but either it's a committee bill, we put them into a committee bill, or we... But anyway, we will excise them. 9 and 10 will come out, but then that means that you won't get them until much later in the year.
Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, just to help Advocate Jiba, Mr. Hoffmeyer had raised this concern with me some time ago. In fact, even before the bill was tabled. And it related to, you recall, the DSO was done away with. Now, Mr. Hoffmeyer's concern was with that you had enormous expertise within the DSO, particularly these financial investigators and accountants, many of whom they have already lost. They've gone, they've moved out, they've been headhunted by the private sector and other organizations. And he said, we need to make sure we keep these people. Now, I think what Advocate Jiba is trying to bring to our attention is that, in her view, I'm listening to her, Clause 10 probably doesn't go far enough. But I think, Advocate Jiba, you also need to listen to our concerns, because we're at the point where we now want to start formal consideration of this. So if your memo to the minister is going to hold us back, say so, and then, well, we would need to decide how to proceed. That's the only... No, I want Advocate Jiba to respond. I don't want them to respond.
The memo went to the minister, so they will also be aware of that.
No. I want to hear Advocate Jiba on this point.
Now, let me respond to this. You know, the clause that presents problems is the clause 10. The other clause is not present problems at all in the NPA.
Okay.
So the memo will only hold us there insofar as clause 10 is concerned. Not the other clause.
Not nine.
Okay.
Are you suggesting then, Advocate Jiba, that we hold back on the whole bill because of clause 10?
No, that's not what I'm suggesting.
Okay.
But here, just to get clarity, you may be asking us to hold back on clause 10.
Yes.
May.
No.
Just clause 10.
Just clause 10.
No, I hear you, Advocate Jiba, and our intention is to try and assist.
I think if we are saying to the SIU and the department to come back next week, we need to know next week from Advocate Jiba whether there are amendments that are going to be proposed from the NPA, or whether you want more time to
want more time, then clause 10 gets assigned. And then you can have as much time as you want. But we need to know that next week. So the may must become a must by next week. Must or do not.
Those are the only two options we have, Advocate Chiba. Is one, is to wait for you to propose amendments to clause 10 by next week. Alternatively, we excise clause 10 and proceed without it.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Steve Swart?
We look forward to hearing the full justification for the suggestion of the excisement of clause 10. But at the same time, we need to balance that with what Advocate Hofmeyer has said. Now, we understand the line function. Obviously, the NPA and acting NDPP is here. But clearly, we need to take an informed decision both ways when we take that decision as to whether excisement should take place or not. But at the moment, as it stands, and clearly we need to hear, maybe we should get that memorandum or a full briefing. But as per the bill at the moment, it indicates a very severe unintended consequence if we do excise clause 10. That's in the bill as before us now, in the memorandum to the bill.
It doesn't mean that exciting clause 10 now means that that's it, it's done away with.
I appreciate that.
That means that it will appear in another amendment bill.
But all I want to say to you is that the Advocate Willy Hofmeyer's concern was the loss of expertise that is ongoing. And we need to balance that with what Advocate Chiba is going to say. So that's all I wanted to raise as a concern. Thank you.
I think Advocate Chiba is fully aware of that.
Thank you.
All right. And that's where we stand with as far as that's concerned. Any reason why we can't deal with a criminal procedure amendment bill?
No.
Well, there's an answer to this, and that's what thank you for corruption watch. How else do you want to do? I've only got it this morning. That's what you say. You discussed it. I mean, many of you commented on Corruption Watch submission. Yes, by all means.
Maybe I can assist you here.
Yes, please.
It is not really, I know it's been given out this morning, but it's not new. It is in fact at the previous meeting, members will remember I gave out or I distributed a copy of the bill, but there was an option one and an option two.
Mm.
Option two is the amendment. What I've distributed this morning is just in techno speak. If you decide on that, that is what it would look like.
Yeah, I was saying to Christine when we were breaking that it's a one line, well, actually two clause bill, but these are all the documents.
No,
you know. It's unbelievable. All right. Yeah, here's mine, Walters. Remember I was talking about the Walters judgment?
Yeah.
Option one and option two. Did we actually give you a decision at the time?
No, I just provided the committee with something to think about. Right. Option one is really not an option if the bill is introduced.
Okay.
And then option two is, if I may refresh your memories, Chair, option two was the sort of in abundance of caution provision to address the concerns of those people who were worried that when it comes to the proviso, the proportionality test would not be a requirement. And we did not, from the department side, we do not agree with that argument, but we thought that seeing as some ostensibly eminent jurists feel that it is a problem, let us just kill it in an ex abundante calcula fashion.
All right. we were given these two options by Mr. De Lange. No, I have that. Manani, are you able to get a copy of this document? This one. Just so that all the members have it. And they can then apply their knowledge to it. Otherwise, I think everyone doesn't have it. It's the document where Mr. De Lange gave us the two options on the option. So please. All right, we'll wait for that.
Maybe if I can assist further, may recall that at that last meeting you also suggested that maybe I approach some people to bounce it off them what they feel like. Now, I've emailed that option to Professors De Vos, to Mervyn Bennen, to Karin van der Walt, to Dr. Johan Berger of the ISS, to Nicola de Havilland of the Care Foundation. Well, at the time she commented in that capacity, so that's why I just put my email list in. I got responses only from Tarin van der Walt. Members will recall she's a senior lecturer in law, she might be a professor as well. And Dr. Johan Berger of the ISS. Tarin, and if I'm translating directly, she said it's not really necessary. I'm of the opinion that it is not necessary to emphasize the proportionality requirement. The bill is clear enough, etc. But it's neither here nor there. She's just feeling that it's not necessary. Dr. Berger said, I just want to inform you that I do not have any real comment on the proposal. It would probably prevent any later uncertainty, but doesn't really change anything to the content of the bill, as we also support it. So it would really be ex abundante calcula if we go this route. And as you said, the only real concern is that some people who know a lot about the law have this concern, so that is the only reason why I want to play.
All right. So essentially, honourable members, one way or the other, option two won't change things that much. But it's really in your hands. Ms. Schaefer?
So if there's any room for doubt at all, and it's not going to make any difference according to the law advisors, I would prefer to go with the more cautious approach, just to make quite clear. Because, I mean, that one comment even said, it may make for, to avoid confusion later and uncertainty later. And if there's any room at all for uncertainty, I would prefer to go with the version that is completely clear.
Which is which? Option two, right? Ms. Smith?
Could I just ask anybody who has read Francois Beckmann's submission whether he is saying anything that I'm not seeing? I mean, in summary, our job here is quite simply to turn the ipsissima verba of Krugler into the law. I mean, that, our job goes no further than that. Is Francois, and which I think we've pretty much cracked, and the only other option was to keep it the way it was. There wasn't a hang of a lot wrong with that anyway. Good morning, Elsa's team. There wasn't a lot wrong with the thing as it stood. But it's basically reminded me because the police kept on saying that they might have forgotten in that. Is that why? Yes. The police couldn't understand when they could shoot to kill or not. What was the wonderful thing Diane Kohler-Barnard said in her speech the other day? When they shoot to kill, they miss. There was some statistic to that effect. All right. So notwithstanding all the really diverting and very serious statistics we read all the time about how many 70,000 people who can't shoot all three types of guns. I don't think that's our task. Our task is to render Krugler into law. And my only question is, and the second option is clearly the one we must take to prevent further noises off. But is Francois saying anything other than that? He isn't, is he?
No,
he isn't.
No, essentially he's saying they must just do their work properly, and they must be properly trained.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so they will not have.
Yes.
The other issue that still concerns me is this issue about no other reasonable means of effecting the arrest, whether at that time or later. I'm really concerned about that. I mean, how
Frank
do
Krugler.
I know it's so complete. How
it must verba.
I know. But I don't, as we know, we don't, never mind, I won't say. But, I mean, the fact of that is, how do you decide at that time that you won't be able to arrest a person later? I mean, on a split-second decision, how can you possibly do that?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. That's why I'll never be a policeman.
No, I know, and it's not easy, but I mean, it worries me that split provision.
Okay. Steve Swart, followed by John Jeffrey.
No, Chair, I appreciate that the wording comes directly from Walker, but I did express a concern of how do you decide at that point. So we need to decide, are we going to go with the exact words from Walter's case, or do we look at that or later? How does one know? I mean, are you going to be prophetic or something? But it is a consideration. Just on the issue of the options, I would agree that we insert these words in the proportionality because the foot, and I'm surprised he actually didn't respond to emailing because he made the comment that the whole proviso, A and B, actually nullifies the proportionality test. So by putting it in belts and braces, we are ensuring that it doesn't. And it was never the intention, I think, but that was his interpretation. So I would have thought that he would have at least had the courtesy to respond to you and say, well, thank you for this. You've now addressed my concern. Thank you.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, I mean, following on Mr. Swart, I do think, I mean, if you look at this bill, it is a 2010 bill. We're now in 2012. We agreed last time that we would follow the Krugler assessment, and all we were looking was for the correct wording. So I do think the issues that Ms. Schaefer and Swart raise, look, we can debate them and consider them and spend another 2 years.
And have more submissions.
So let's just, you know, do what we agreed on last time and go with Krugler. And then I think it's we had, though, just wanted it bounced off, I think, with Professor de Vos. Maybe Mr. Lange used the wrong means of communication. Maybe he would have been better off responding to his blog.
Yes.
He might have got something. But anyway, be that as it may, if he was given the opportunity, that's fine. Mine is just, I mean, Mr. Lange is the expert on this one, but the document we've got in before us, it's not the easiest to read. omit provided that the arrester and substitute provided that the arrester. It may be, look, it may be, but it just may, you know, the other way that often is used is that should not the whole of two, you know, delete the whole of two and substitute the whole of two as written out properly. It's just that, but basically, I suppose, Tim, my question would be to Mr. DeLange, should we do it this way, or should we say delete clause 2 and substitute the new clause 2 with the correct wording? Because I actually battled to figure out what was happening here, and it was only in looking at the draft you gave us last time that I was able to see what was going where. So, see, I don't know if you, Mr. DeLange, can give a response. Otherwise, I want to move for adoption.
This is actually a simple, but to me, members, just to call, this is really an instruction to the printer. The bill is something else. This is just to indicate to the printer what the bill will look like once it's done. And this committee, my ad is about the only privileged committee in Parliament who get amendments where we actually give them the whole bill, showing how we're changing it. But the other poor committees, they've got to battle with these kind of things.
Well, I was going to say 10, but all right. Okay.
I never agreed to go with a quick adjustment. I've raised this concern about since.
No. All right. What's your position on record then?
Is that
a
DA position?
I don't know.
No, but that is a difficulty, because then I think that we can't go ahead and move it. Why? I mean, Deputy, isn't a question with respect that what we have to do is what the Constitutional Court says. Mm. And in this case, Judge Kriegler has given us the words. And I think, because, I mean, I'm not insensitive to your concern, and Steve, but remember that he also speaks about a certain kind of crime is also one of the criteria. It's not just that you're imminent, you're going to get blasted from the face of the earth or other bystanders. It's also the nature of the crime at issue. And it's clearly in that context that at this time or any other time later comes into play, I would think. So you can also use deadly force when you're trying to arrest someone who is accused of a really serious kind of crime. That's also part of the thinking. It's also part of international thinking. But it is also specifically part of the Kriegler ruling. And I would think that at that time or any other is part of that thinking. But irrespective of whether it is or not, those are the actual words the judge has taken the trouble to set out in a way not normally done in judgments, in relatively plain language, what is constitutional, what is the law. It is our task to put that into the law. There's simply no question about it.
All right, we're just waiting for those documents, Mr. DeLange, provided. Here they are. Good.
This is the good option for that last time.
Yes. Options 1 and 2.
What we got given last time.
So I tell you what.
Why don't we let ask Mr. DeLange to do the usual thing, spoil the committee, write it out the way it'll look, and then at the next meeting we do that, bring it to a conclusion.
Mr. Jeffrey?
It's fine, it's just
I suppose we can adopt it tomorrow, but I really don't see why we can't adopt it now. Unless
the king also doesn't want it. Something the king also wants it.
And who also doesn't want it?
The king.
Because it would be good to get it into the plenary next week.
I suppose we don't have to if we can pass it tomorrow, we don't have to suspend three-day rules, but as long as, but then we must do it tomorrow.
Can we agree with that?
I'm
very reluctant.
I would do it now, but I bow to the
royalty
next to me. And the others who asked, you know, my order members are quite happy. So
not your members.
I'm talking to the family, and I do agree with my husband. And no, just be sensible now.
All right, Mr. DeLanger, will you do that for us?
Maybe we should do it in 24. 72, otherwise.
Option 2, just one document with a bill as it
goes.
Yes, please. All right. Okay.
Chair, I think just if we're going to be then adopting tomorrow, is there anything we want to say in the committee report? It would seem that really it's probably better not to say anything.
In the committee report?
Yes.
All right.
About the bill.
What would you want?
Well, I mean, we usually go and say things like we're concerned about this or that, and
the police must be properly trained,
and the police must be properly trained. But I think it is a. I mean, the only thing we could say is that we adopted the approach that we wanted legal certainty rather than easy to understand. That it's up to the police to make it easy to understand. We wanted to have legal certainty, but I don't think it's even necessary to say that. And then,
well, it's up to you all.
I'd say we don't have any.
No.
All right, fine. So what do we have left?
Nothing.
All right. Honourable members, Ms. Dean Smuts wants to raise the issue of Ms. Glynis Breitenbach. Let me first address you. My difficulty is the sub judice rule. Sorry? Not in court. All right, if it's not in court.
Sir, yes, what my concern is about the disciplinary process.
Thank you. Yes, I'm listening.
Thank you, gentlemen. No, I just want to be rude. The background, I'm sure I don't need to sketch to you that it is alleged that she was shot at. It is alleged that there was an attempt to force her off the road, I think at that 25th of last month, the shot on the 11th of last month. I just remind you, as a matter of record, that Major General Henkel, in his report to the Inspector General of Intelligence, noted at paragraph 6.3 that the investigations into what are, after all, the very same matter that eventually became a fraud charge at the NBI. During those investigations, there were attempts to interfere with and derail the investigations, and there were threats to the lives and safety of the people investigating. Now, to me, that is a background against which the alleged attempts on her physical safety are very serious. The case that was dropped, the fraud charges against the Lieutenant General, derived directly from the other investigation, the Major General Henkel investigation. So it might stand to reason that whoever tried to interfere with investigations at that stage did again this time. The long and the short of it is that this is a prosecutor who says that she's convinced that the thing ought not to have been dropped. But her safety is an issue, and it seems to me that we must indicate quite clearly to the public that we are keeping an eye. Now, I think what governs the prison proceedings, she's suspended pending investigation into a charge that does not relate to them. Clearly it relates to the ICT Kumba session or matter. It is frequently reported that is not really what all of this is about, without any evidence, of course, being supplied. But I do think that we have a duty to just indicate that we are aware that this is going on, that we would like to be kept informed after the disciplinary proceedings perhaps have been curtailed. Why, for example, can we not ask Advocate Jeeba for a copy, a verbatim, a transcription of the proceedings at the disciplinary inquiry? Why can't we ask, that would be after the fact. Why, therefore, we're not interfering or intruding, even though this is not sub judice, it's simply a disciplinary process. Those usually occur in conditions of confidentiality. In this case, I would say we should say we want to see it after the fact. But why, in addition, can we not ask to see the actual, whatever one calls a charge sheet in the case of employment disciplinaries? Why can't we see what the actual accusation is in respect of the ICC Kumba? What is it she is alleged to have done? Is it just that she sat in the back of a courtroom with Advocate Helens, or what? But why can we not ask to see what it is she's charged with? What is the misconduct? And then after the fact to see the proceedings of the disciplinary. I'm looking for some way to indicate for us as a committee, formally, that we are aware of this and that we take an interest and keep an eye.
I share similar concerns as expressed by my colleague Dean. I was very concerned, and I'm sure we were all concerned when we saw those newspaper reports. What I would like to know is whether steps have been taken to protect her. And I think that's for me. I raised this October 2 years ago when there were other, and we raised it in general terms as well. It's not only this particular prosecutor. We are raised the concerns about whether prosecutors that are threatened have sufficient, there are mechanisms in place, and I was given the assurance that they are. The NPA does have that capacity. So is it been applied in this case for bodily protection, even though she is suspended? As far as the disciplinary action is concerned, it is important for us to be monitoring it, but I suppose similarly there are other disciplinary actions as well. Do we not adopt a similar attitude, or how do we justify focusing so much on this case? Is it because it's in the media? Yes. There's a wide sense of disquiet, and I had a kind of sense of outrage, but it might have been misplaced because I didn't have all the information, and it might be that if we had more information after the disciplinary action, there might well be justification for that suspension. But I think the public perception is you've got allegations against a lieutenant general, serious allegations, he was suspended, he's reinstated, so you've got the investigator who is suspended. And I think when you, and it might be totally incorrect, my perception, but that's what gave me that sense of outrage. And so I think it is important that we do, at the very least, monitor this and say we are aware of the situation, and that we are requesting whether steps have been taken to protect this prosecutor and other prosecutors. Because there were the General Bar Council, and I think the Law Society has also issued concerns. There's an advocate, I think it's Makranazi from Northcliffe. His flat was, or home was broken into, and only certain files were taken relating allegedly to the Mugabe matter. So there are a number of advocates that seem to be targeted, and I think that we need to be aware of the General Bar Council also expressing concerns about this issue without going into a great degree of detail. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. John Jeffrey, followed by Debbie Schaefer.
I'm not sure I'm going to Debbie go.
All right, Debbie.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I obviously want to support my colleague Dean Smith. I think, and I understand what Steve is saying, is obviously we can't sort of handpick certain investigations and certain disciplinaries, but the fact of the matter is that this one is different in the context. And I think the very least that we could and should do is find out more details about exactly what she is charged with, because if there is a valid charge on the face of it, then fine, we can at least be assured that the process will take its course. If the charge sheet does not disclose a prima facie valid defence, then obviously we have reason to be concerned about why she is in fact being suspended. So I would support the request and ask that we do in fact ask for a copy of the charge sheet so we can have more detail as to what exactly they are.
I mean, we haven't discussed it ANC or anything, but I think my worry is there's an enormous, I mean, there's a lot of media material. There is a, and it's not clear exactly what is happening. there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on. I don't know if I can be protected. The issue then is around a particular a disciplinary case around a particular prosecutor. I think similar, I mean, the issue is obviously one's concerned about what's happening, but we also need to, we can't just, we need to be careful around the precedents that are being set. We don't get involved in disciplinary matters are a matter for the NPA. It would appear that there is to be a disciplinary hearing into Advocate Breitenbach. Presumably, if she is found guilty of anything, she can appeal against it. There is a Labour Court, there's a Labour Appeal Court. So I'm just worried about the committee formally getting involved in a particular matter. Why are we getting involved in this matter? Because we think it's linked to the General and Julie matter, because it all seems a bit vague. We have the budget debate on Thursday. I don't know why members can't raise the concerns in the debate. We will be having the NPA back again. They come in an account regularly. But I'm just not that comfortable with starting to get involved in operational issues, of wanting to see the charge sheet. So we get the charge sheet, then what happens? Are we going to then start interrogating the NPA on the charge sheet? Because that obviously is the next thing that would flow. So, yeah, my gut feeling is it's better to have the issues raised in debate on Thursday. Individual members can raise issues, raise concerns, write to the minister, whatever. When the NPA, the national director, comes next to the committee, they're meant to come for quarterly reports. The issue can be taken further. But as far as the issue of the charge sheet, as I said, my difficulty is why this case. If we get the charge sheet and we don't agree with it, then our members going to want to start effectively interfering in the whole matter. The personal safety issue, I think that's an issue of any member of the National Prosecuting Authority, any member of the Department of Justice, any judicial officer who is under threat should be provided with security where there's a real threat. But again, I don't think it's correct to start singling out people as the committee. If individual members want to do that, fine. But as the committee, why this person and not somebody else?
Thank you, Chair. I support the sentiments expressed by Honourable JJ. I think as a committee, if we start asking, there may be something that is of concern that may be worrying members, but to ask for charge sheets, wouldn't it really be overstepping our mandate? because I guess we need to operate within our own mandate as a committee. And this is why, therefore, when there is business that is operational, that is taking place, we need to allow due process to take place. We will develop interest in the outcome of due process. And of course, like Comrade, like Honorable Member Jeffries indicates, if there is need for appeal, there will be appeal. And while we feel that rights have been violated as a committee, we will take the matter serious. And I'm sure at that point, we can be in the position to really manage to decide as to what steps needs to be taken. What will be difficult in this matter would be, how do you then decide as a committee which of the cases of what's happening in government departments we will intervene in this matter also on? How do you put the thermometer and decide this is a special case? It's very difficult, and I think trying to do it wouldn't be possible, let alone the fact that you will be overstepping our mandate.
Chair, we obviously as individual MPs can continue but to monitor the situation, but it would be good if the committee, this is not just a normal case, but bear in mind this is the head, she's the head of the commercial crimes unit. She's a very senior advocate. So we need to be mindful of the fact that there is massive public awareness of this, and that we as a committee should take some stance or some indication that we are exercising our monitoring function by at the very least being aware of the disciplinary action. And I'm particularly concerned about the personal safety. And I think that at the very least we can request the NPA to advise us as to what steps have been taken to protect her. That would not be out of our ambit. We've raised it before. Here are serious allegations. This is facts that are on the table before us, and it wouldn't be acceptable if we do not, at the very least, ask the NPA to explain what steps have been taken to protect her, considering that she has reported the incident to the Hawks, and the fact that it's not just she's sucking it out of her thumb. There are very serious allegations of attempts on her life. I think we need to be, at the very least, mindful of that. See, this just, I don't know, you might rule me out of order, but I also had a bit of a concern when we talk about the Ndluli matter about the state legal advisor also heading up an investigation. Now, I don't know whether we can do anything about that, but what is this now?
Yeah, what is this now?
Surely, in exercising our oversight function, he has got no mandate to investigate matters. He's already complained about the workload that they've got. Do we not need to also ask questions about,
yes,
in terms of what acts does he have investigative powers, in terms of how will this impact upon his workload, and was the Minister of Justice approached at all to approve his appointment to this investigation, which is an investigation into a letter, not the broader investigation, but a pure letter. So I must apologize for going slightly off the topic, but it's an issue that I also wanted to raise. Thank
May
you.
I formally support that and make it part of the topic?
Mr. Holloway, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I think it's incumbent upon us as a committee, Chairperson, to indicate our concern when matters of this nature grab the attention of the public. I know that the public opinion tends to be generated more by the media, and sometimes for various reasons. And we have to be cautious, therefore, of at all times regarding what the media makes out to be something of national importance, to follow it accordingly. We need to use our own discretion as to whether this particular matter is one that calls on us to take some steps. Because, as has been said by other members, we don't want to set precedents that we may not be able to contain in the future. But at the same time, it should be known by the public that as a committee of what's monitoring the Justice Department, whenever things of this nature occur, we do indicate our concern. Now, normally, therefore, we would have had to invite the responsible official, maybe the head of the NPA, to come and brief us as to what exactly is happening here. But I am confident that the minister is going to throw some light on this matter when the debate occurs, and also members will be free to express themselves in order also maybe to provoke the minister to show more light. So in the circumstances, therefore, for the moment, I don't think we want to call for charge sheets and things like that to be brought to us. Let us hear what the minister is going to say, because it's expected of him to say it. And maybe we might want to ask you, Jefferson, to, if you have a way to talk to him and indicate that the committee is concerned about this and it would like to see some light being shed, especially by him, in the course of the debate. And then we can take it from there, think that maybe to what extent the members are satisfied with the clarity that will have been given by the minister over what is happening and what is being done in the debate.
Sure.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, I take that point. But, I mean, really, we've seen before the minister will answer what questions he wants to answer. There's no guarantee he's going to answer us. If he comes and discusses it, that'll be welcome. Up to my colleague who made the proposal, whether she's happy with that, to replace the current proposal. But I don't think, I do hear concerns about precedent, but the reality of the matter is that this is not an ordinary matter. If any other similar matter came to this committee, I'm quite sure we would support similar kind of action being taken. And so the question really is that whatever has been in the public domain does not disclose a prima facie offence. So the question is asked, why has she been suspended? And obviously the political questions are being asked, and I don't understand how it is not within our mandate of oversight to ask for that document. I'm not sure on what basis people are saying that it doesn't fall within our mandate. It is a distinct high-profile case, which on the face of it does not disclose an offence that has been committed by this woman. So why is she suspended? And on that basis, I think it is our duty to do this.
Second round, all right.
Yes, let's just say, in regard to things that have been said, do not forget that the minister's powers in respect of the NPA are extremely limited, although they have prosecutorial independence, as you know. The minister has so-called final responsibility in the Constitution. Final responsibility is defined in the Act at Section 33, to mean that he can ask the prosecuting heads for a little bit of information on this, that, and the other. He is not supposed to run the NPA. And the NPA already is not sufficiently independent. It isn't institutionally independent. That's why I have frequently called from 2010 onwards for a different appointment mechanism for the NDCP and various other matters. So I'm not even sure that the minister is the right person from whom to expect an answer. We, in fact, have greater powers than he has in Section 35 in respect of the right to ask about prosecutions. Now, this is indirectly about a prosecution. It's about the Matluli prosecution, and I already exercised my Section 35 rights when we did the budget hearings. This is a possibly and potentially related matter. And all I want to say on that, I mean, I think I made it clear that it's not crystal clear to me what exact modality we can use. I think maybe after the fact we ask for the transcript of the disciplinary. Asking for the charge sheet, I fully realize will set a precedent. I fully realize it's actually even problematic. But I think in these strange circumstances, it has the great virtue not only of showing that we take this seriously, but also of bringing transparency. And at the end of the day, the greatest safety lies in transparency, which is why, even though one is left not knowing what is really going on after the media coverage, at least there is, the light is being shone into dark corners, and that, if anything, will keep her safer. And I just think we could contribute to that safety and to the anti-corruption properties of transparency, sunshine being the best disinfectant, by making it clear that we are watching.
Yeah, I'm not clear what we are being asked for. There seem to be two issues. One, getting the charge sheet, and two, the protection for Ms. Breitenbach. Ms. Smuts seems to agree with the fact that there are problems with asking for the charge sheet. So I'm not quite sure if she's still wanting it. But the difficulty is there are a number of, in any organization, spats within the NPA which result in people getting charged. There is and Ms. Smuts is well aware of it. I mean, she is in fact the one that raised it in one particular province. Issues between two very senior prosecutors, a dispute, accusations, counter-accusations. We didn't ask for the, we didn't ask for details on that. I think there may even be because of the complaint a disciplinary inquiry. So that's my uncomfortableness with asking for the charge sheet, because the issue is once you get the charge sheet, and Ms. Schaefer is raising it, she wants to know, is there a basis for charging? The question then is going to be, having a look at the charge sheet, why is it worded like this, not like that? What is the evidence that you've got? So that is my worry with that, that I think it is setting a wrong precedent. Ms. Smuts, though, does speak about expressing the need for us to be concerned, and I think that is fine. And as I said, I think that is something that can be raised in the debate, not to the minister, but to the acting national director who will be sitting there, although she obviously won't be able to reply. And when she presented on the budget, some of these issues were raised, and she responded. When she comes back, or if there's a new national director appointed, they can respond. So I think that the most we could do is issue that the committee could issue a statement. But why we need to do that? We haven't done that before. When there is a debate the day after tomorrow, and members can speak in that debate. All of us, and we can all raise our concerns. So that is my difficulty, Chair. And then I think as well, we can't. So that's basically my difficulty.
And then the Chair would like to make a few comments.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I was duty whip when the police portfolio committee was having budget debate. A matter which was in the public domain, which is almost similar to this one that we are talking about, was that one of Richard Kidoni. I think the approach that was taken by the various speakers as well as the minister is an approach which we must consider, in my opinion, following chapter 10. And then I would also support the view that maybe we have a justice portfolio committee, we issue a statement. But I am also uncomfortable when we say we'll be calling upon court process in touch with the event. It has never happened before. Thank you so much.
All right. I've heard you, and I could just throw in my little bit. I don't know
Dennis Breidenbach is the head of commercial crimes unit. It's a very senior position. So if shots are fired at him, then it's cause for concern. Let's say that up front. With regard to the question of the charge sheet, I mean, we haven't quite rounded up our discussion or debate on the extent of the NPA's accountability to this committee. We still seized with that matter. Essentially, it's stuck at how far do we go? And that is where this question of the charge sheet comes in. Now, the elephant in the room is Richard Mugabe. And I think members are quite correct. You're free to raise these matters in the budget debate on Thursday. I have serious concerns. I have very strong views on this entire matter. And let me express, these are my personal concerns. I've not shared them with anybody. I'm expressing this for the first time. Personally, I believe a Judicial Commission of Inquiry should be appointed to investigate the Richard Mugabe matter and all related matters. That's my personal view. Yeah. I said, I think the manner in which we're dealing with all these matters is very ad hoc. Yeah. And it doesn't inspire confidence at all. Let me give you an example. The Inspector General of Intelligence conducted an investigation. And at the end of the investigation, she recommended that Richard Mugabe be charged. And then a short while later came back and said, no, I dropped those charges. Now she's investigating again. Now, there's no clarity on exactly why, how, when, where. You know, you just told briefly that, yes, she's now investigating again. And so that's one of the sources of my concern. And I said as much to the public protector. I said, look, this is where the problem lies. Initially, she had said he must be charged. Mm-hmm. And then she recanted and said, no, drop the charges. But those are just my own personal views, and until then, you're going to be faced with this ad hoc approach, which is, well, it leaves a lot to be desired. I'm also concerned about the appointment of the Chief Technical Advisor to investigate. I read that and I shook my head. Like you, I wondered whether it was done in consultation with our Minister of Justice and whether he approves. It's not part of his mandate to investigate. His mandate is to provide legal advice. We have any number of investigators in government and outside government who quite easily have done what he is being asked to do. And so, given all these different efforts, the public protector is going to come in any minute now, the Inspector General is conducting, I think, a third investigation. Chief State Law Advisor is doing his own investigation. There's the disciplinary matter on Dennis Breidenbach. It's for that reason that I think it cries out for a Judicial Commission of Inquiry. Mm-hmm. With powers of search and seizure, mm-hmm. with powers to subpoena and summon people and things. That would be the only way. That's my personal view. I need to stress this to all of you sitting here. This is not the ANC's position. It is not the committee's position. It's Llewellyn Landers' view. So if you write something else, I'm going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. Trust me.
But you wouldn't mind, Chair, if one made the point that it is very powerful coming from you,
no,
that it can't be a committee position for other reasons,
Dean,
that we agree.
This is the difficulty with asking for the charge sheet. I mean, I had informally discussed this with Mr. Jeffrey and indirectly with Mr. Sibanioni. And we had agreed. We said, well, okay, today it's Glynis Breidenbach, but other people have been disciplined, have had hearings and been sanctioned in the NPA. This committee didn't bother. So on what basis now do we say, well, in this case, we want all the details of the charge sheet, transcripts of the hearings, and so on? That's the difficulty. I understand and I agree with you that this person is senior enough, but then are we saying that the junior prosecutor is not important? The junior prosecutor is shot at? This committee won't express a view? Shouldn't? No, that's the point I'm making. It might have happened in the past and we've been silent. No. Whether we knew about it or not, the point is that these are things, honourable members, you need to think about and apply your minds to, so that when we get down to discussing the accountability of the NPA to Parliament and this committee, we need to be clear in our minds just how far we go. So that when we do take those steps, we do so in concert. That's about all I can say. I would urge you to raise this in Thursday's debate. I will follow Mr. Holomis' suggestion and try and speak to the minister. I can't guarantee that I will reach him, and try and obtain some clarity from him ahead of Thursday, but at the very least to say to him, look, please come prepared to respond to members' concerns that will arise on Thursday's during Thursday's debate. And
please, may I urge you to say, if you're going to convey that message to him, please do it in the context that we appreciate the fact that he is not supposed to run the NPA, and that his final responsibility, Section 33, is very limited. So don't let send the wrong message.
No, he's a lawyer. He's a good lawyer. And you're assuming that he's unaware of this.
No, I'm assuming...
And you're assuming that because I say this to him, he's going to say, oh, well, in that case, I'll take charge of the NPA.
No, I don't want us to sound as though we're assuming that he, therefore, has... Talk about setting precedent, then you're setting the wrong precedent.
Fair enough. I hear you. I didn't think that was what Mr. Holomisa intended at all.
No.
I simply thought Mr. Holomisa was trying to say, please ask the minister if he can take us into his confidence and give us the necessary information, plain and simple. My frustration with this whole matter is that there are a few people that are privy to what is actually happening. And the rest of us, well, we're speculating wildly. The media have certain information that has been provided to them from their sources. And that's not a healthy situation at all.
It is powerful. And
so, that's as far as we can take this matter.
Right.
For now. When the NPA does appear before this committee, or if we ask them to come and give us a briefing or a report, we can take the matter further as well.
Yes.
All right? Thank you.
Thank you for letting me know.
Tomorrow's meeting, we'll deal with the Sheriff's Amendment Bill. We'll receive two presentations or two briefings tomorrow on the Sheriff's Bill. It's one of the bills that I think we should try and finish, but, well, the sheriffs aren't exactly helpful. So it may be a little difficult in that regard.
And then, of course, did Mr. De Lange say he would come back tomorrow? No, he didn't. Did he say tomorrow?
Yeah.
On the criminal procedure.
Yeah.
And then if he does, and we're happy with what he places before us, can we, honourable members, look at expediting criminal procedure, please? Yes. So it will be Sheriff, the two briefings, it will be Criminal Procedure Amendment Bill, and it will be the budget report, honourable members. Please, all right? So please read the budget report carefully. All right. Thank you. We're adjourned. I hope I haven't stolen your documents.